WHYY is proudly supported by Penn Medicine. From groundbreaking discoveries to life-saving care, Penn Medicine's innovation is helping to change lives, one moment, one treatment, one patient at a time.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Elizabeth is the new period drama about Queen Elizabeth, starring Australian actress Kate Blanchett, who's being touted as an Oscar contender for her performance. Our film critic John Powers has a review.
While TV programs about history are usually illustrated lessons, movies about history tend to be grandiose potboilers. That's precisely the case with Elizabeth, an extremely entertaining feminist soap opera filled with so much sex, murder, and treachery that Geraldo must regret he wasn't born in the 16th century. It begins in 1554, when England's in trouble. Abroad, it's being threatened by France and Spain. At home, Queen Mary is trying to restore Catholicism as the country's faith. But there's one big problem. Since the ailing Mary will die childless, her successor will be her half-sister Elizabeth, played by Kate Blanchett, and Elizabeth happens to be a Protestant. Although Catholic loyalists try to block her ascent to the throne, Elizabeth does become the queen of the weak, divided, insolvent country. And to her court's dismay, she doesn't do what she's told, namely marry a suitor from either France or Spain. Intent on being her own woman, she initially flaunts her relationship with her unreliable lover, Robert Dudley, played rather boringly by Joseph Fiennes. But the canny Elizabeth soon realizes that she'll be dead if she doesn't make herself into a proper queen. She begins taking the advice of her official protector, Sir Francis Walsingham, a Machiavellian spymaster superbly played by Geoffrey Rush from Shine. Here, after a disastrous battle in Scotland, Walsingham gives Elizabeth a small lesson in realpolitik.
Why did they send such children? Why did they not send proper reinforcements?
Because the bishops would not let them. They spoke against it in the pulpits.
Then they are speaking against their queen.
Madam, the bishops are against you and have no fear of you. They do not expect you to survive.
Elizabeth was written by Michael Hirst, who won't exactly have professional historians celebrating his devotion to the facts. By merging various characters and events, he transforms a true story into something more exciting, an Elizabethan version of The Godfather. Like Michael Corleone, Elizabeth goes from being an innocent bystander to one who learns how to pull the strings of power. The movie even has the visual darkness of The Godfather. It begins with a stylized torture scene done in inky blacks, and aside from a few sun-stunned outdoor sequences, most of the action takes place in dank castles, where shadows threaten to devour the characters in their exquisitely layered gowns. I mention the clothing because the whole movie is filled with a kind of arresting photography, odd camera angles and so forth, that's more appropriate to a fashion spread than a film. Yet while the movie's look is self-conscious, the storytelling is not. Elizabeth is vigorously directed by Shekhar Kapoor, whose last film was The Bandit Queen, the real-life story of Poolan Devi, a low-caste Indian woman who triumphed over forced marriage and gang rape to become a political leader. While this new movie marks a clear advance for Kapoor, it tells a similar story of a woman learning to claim her own power. There's been no better woman's role this year than Elizabeth, and the fine Australian actress Kate Blanchett wears it like a diamond tiara. Blanchett has a difficult beauty. It can go from ethereal to spiky in the flicker of an eyelash. And she uses it to give us several very different Elizabeths. The sweet-natured innocent who's in too deep. The carnal creature who dances a sexy volta with her lover. The increasingly confident sovereign who publicly toys with Catholic bishops. And the imperious queen who insists on her own absolute authority. "I am no man's Elizabeth," she says fiercely. Although the movie's not deep, it is well aware that you don't get power for free. Just as becoming godfather turned Michael Corleone into a moral monster, so Elizabeth eventually becomes an eerie ghost of a monarch, her hair cropped, her face so smeared with white makeup that she resembles a glazed donut. She has seized the authority she will wield for the next 40 years, yet her public triumph is also something of a personal tragedy. All the lightness has gone from her spirit. Unable to survive as both queen and full-blooded woman, she makes herself into a denatured icon, the Virgin Queen. She may be the first recorded case in history of that media cliché, the career woman who discovers you can't have it all.
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Film director Alan J. Pakula died yesterday in a freak car accident. He was driving home on the Long Island Expressway when a 7-foot metal pipe crashed through the windshield of his car, striking him in the head. His car then hit a fence. Pakula was 70 years old. He started his film career in the early 60s, producing To Kill a Mockingbird and Love with a Proper Stranger. He went on to direct The Sterile Cuckoo, Clute, The Parallax View, All the President's Men, Starting Over, Sophie's Choice, Presumed Innocent, and The Pelican Brief. He was working on an adaptation of No Ordinary Time, Doris Kearns Goodwin's book about Franklin and Eleanor Roosevelt. In 1990, Fresh Air guest host Sedge Thompson spoke with Pakula. Sedge is the host of West Coast Live, which is carried on many public radio stations. Let's start with a scene from Pakula's legal thriller Presumed Innocent. Harrison Ford stars as a prosecuting attorney investigating the brutal murder of a colleague with whom he'd had a secret affair. Halfway through the investigation, the DA's office is given evidence that implicates Harrison Ford. Brian Dennehy plays the district attorney.
Molto and DeLay have raised some questions about the Polhemus investigation.
This should not be handled this way. You should speak with Rusty alone.
What's this about?
It's about the fact that you were in Carolyn's apartment the night she was killed.
Bullshit. What was that, a Tuesday night? Barbara was at the university. I was babysitting.
Rusty. For your own sake, keep your mouth shut.
We've got the fingerprint results. The ones you could never remember to ask for. And they're your prints all over the bar glass. Yours, Rosette K. Savage. 5 feet from where the woman was found dead. Or maybe you didn't remember that all county employees get printed.
My God, you're serious.
Alan Pakula co-wrote and directed the screen adaptation of Scott Turow's novel, Presumed Innocent. He spent a year on the script after reading the first draft of the screenplay.
If you're doing a suspense film, it is very important the audience have certain facts, so they always know where they're at, so they know what to hope for or what to be afraid of. That's where the excitement comes from. That's where the suspense comes from. If the audience has no set of facts that they can relate to, then there's no suspense, and you have to have this feeling of, oh, this could happen or this can happen. Which one will happen? That's suspense. If you don't have enough set of facts to say, to have that, to ask those questions, then you just sort of go along staring at the story, but there is not that kind of excitement. And with a story this complicated, with this many characters, this kind of character study, whodunit, you're always juggling these characters, making sure that the audience doesn't have too many names that they have to follow, too many clues they have to follow at once. Harrison Ford and I kept asking questions of each other every second. We would test each other by saying, all right, what do you know now about this story? Tell me, as the audience, where are you? What information do you have and what don't you have? We would keep checking.
There's a need in the course of one of these stories to place clues, facts or clues, as you go along. And how did you decide to wait certain clues versus others? Did you want the audience to try to figure out the story?
I wanted the audience to feel they were always on the verge of figuring out the story, that they were about to do it and then be teased along that much farther and given another clue that might throw them off the track. There have been several films this summer that have been physical roller coaster rides. This one is really a mental roller coaster ride in a sense, in that you are taken in one direction and then suddenly another clue takes you in another direction. And that's the fascination of this kind of thing. At the same time, unlike the ordinary melodrama story, or in the average melodrama story, Scott Turow wrote very complicated, rich characters. And you then have to stop to really develop those characters at the same time. Hitchcock once said, one of the most difficult things to do is to do character studies and suspense at the same time because the rhythms are different. So you're always balancing those rhythms. How long can you stop for character? You really can never let that story go. The great gift that Scott gave us was this extraordinary plot. At the same time, that plot became our master. We always had to serve it. In an ordinary film, you can you know, be more leisurely and start exploring character for its own sake. Here, character always had to be revealed within the context of the plot being revealed.
Your lead, Harrison Ford, who played Rusty Savage, is a guy I associate with a fedora, a whip, or a ray gun. And here he played a very closed-in, repressed character. What did you have to do with him to get him to play this much more sort of quiet, passive, reactive rather than active role?
Actually, he's not a passive character. Indeed, events seem to take him over in many ways, but I wouldn't say that he's passive. He's a passionate prosecuting attorney when the story opens. He's a man of deep emotions. As a matter of fact, what I find interesting about the character is that it is a very active man who finds himself in a very passive position. The prosecutor is very active, and suddenly he finds himself on trial for murder, where you really are in a passive position. At the same time, he does, even during that period, have efforts in trying to deal with the case. It's a very difficult thing to ask an actor to do, especially a man who's played Indiana Jones. And the time when you work on that is even before he's decided to do it. I went out to Harrison's ranch in Wyoming when we had a script, and we spent several days together and we read through the script, because while Harrison was interested, he was concerned about playing this role for the very reasons you pointed out. And I read all the other characters, and he read Rusty Savage's character. I read all the other characters badly, I might add, and I was surprised that he could even sound at all real, considering he was playing these scenes over a kitchen table with me. But during that time, we would stop and start, and you would find and discuss all of the active things going on in this character, even though he may not be revealing them on, obviously, in dialogue. And during that time, we really found the arc of the character, the growth of the character, all of the things that might not be revealed in an immediate reading of the script, where so many of the other characters have so much more bravura dialogue, for example, than his character has. It was once, I think, Harrison saw how rich the character was in an interior way that he could, one, commit himself to do the film, and then allow himself to give such a controlled performance. The difficulty in playing that kind of character is you can't cheat. If you're playing a man who's has deep feeling but has a difficult time revealing it, he better darn well be feeling that deep feeling so that that audience has some sense that something is going on underneath. Otherwise, it'll be totally empty.
We're listening back to an interview with director Alan Pakula, who died yesterday at the age of 70. We'll hear more after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to our 1990 interview with director Alan Pakula in conversation with Fresh Air guest host Sedge Thompson. Pakula died yesterday.
You've produced and directed many great films over the years, many of them from books, including To Kill a Mockingbird, Up the Down Staircase, Sophie's Choice, All the President's Men, Presumed Innocent. What is it about books that attracts you as a director, to screenplays?
Well, it's, by the way, I also do things like Clute that are from original screenplays.
Right, right, well.
I just want you to think that I'm a purist about only doing books. However, there is a great attraction in books, and that is all the extraordinary texture, the world you have to draw upon in a really good novel. There is so much background texture, subtext, you might call it. It'll be subtext in a film anyway, that gives that sense of reality and richness that you have to draw upon that is sometimes more difficult to get in an original screenplay. I sometimes think that too often the average screenwriter will spend too short a time doing a screenplay, maybe weeks or months. This is not always the case, but in many cases. And a good novelist is very often spent years in developing that world and developing those characters. And that time very often has paid off in giving you just a much richer world to work with. I'm not saying, by the way, that a genius or somebody like Preston Sturges can't write a great movie in a week or two, because There are cases of that. But by and large, having that kind of background world that the novel gives you to inform a film can be very helpful indeed. Now, that has other problems. I mean, you're taking something that was designed to function in one way and asking it to function in another way. And there are many novels, I would say, that by their very nature are almost impossible to do as films.
How did you first learn to read a screenplay?
How did I learn to read a screenplay? Nobody's asked me that. I learned to read a screenplay when I had my first job at MGM. I was in love with the theater. I was a theater director when I got out of Yale. And I was 20 and at that age thought I knew a good deal more than I did, as it turned out. And it never occurred to me I had to learn how to read a screenplay. I got my first job at MGM and I was reading screenplays and making a lot of, I think, unfair, arrogant judgments, and I think in making those judgments, found out a good deal about what worked and what didn't work. I remember being at Paramount, and I was about 21, 22, and reading a screenplay of Rear Window, and thinking, well, it's all very pleasant, but I don't really get the suspense in this. You know, I'm strange that Hitchcock is doing this film when it doesn't seem to have very much suspense. Well,
that must have startled you when you saw the film.
Well, when I began seeing dailies, I began learning a great deal of humility, because the difference between what is on the written page and what a director may have in mind, can be extraordinary. And while it was a perfectly craftsmanlike screenplay, the vision that Hitchcock had that informed that film was extraordinary. And I sometimes think that even today that people who make the decisions about what films should be made and should not be made don't know how to read a screenplay. Very often will skim over because they read so many scripts, they'll take home 10 or 15 scripts to read over a weekend because they have all these decisions to make. And I think when you read that way, there's a tendency to kind of read through the dialogue, you know, and that can be a very bad way to read a screenplay because that's not how the film's going to look. I also think that people, this is my advice to executives today, I think, should really not judge a screenplay until, if there was a director involved, make a final judgment, until they've discussed the screenplay with the director and see exactly what he has in mind and how much that vision is reflected by the screenplay. But those two things should go together in making the final decision.
There's a scene in Clute, which was from an original screenplay, where Jane Fonda sings a hymn, and I understand this was actually not part of the screenplay. I wonder how her, a call girl in the movie, began to sing this hymn and how it became included in the movie.
Well, that's a wonderful thing about working with actors. I always say to actors, however much we rehearse, and I believe in rehearsing, nothing pleases me more than surprises. What happens in the moment? What comes out of your own behavior? In Clute, again, we had the problem of a melodrama that was really a character study, and the two rhythms. I mean, how much time could you take to explore character? So we didn't. While she was this complicated call girl, we didn't reveal a great deal about her background, and we looked for ways to do that. And here she is. It was a scene at the very early part of the picture, and she's just picked up a trick. And just had the trick, and now she's home in her apartment alone, and she's smoking pot at that point, and sitting there and relaxing. And at that moment, I was also trying to dramatize it. In some ways, that trick for her was a fix, not a sexual fix. Somewhere or other, it was a release of some kind of compulsive tensions. And for that moment, there was a moment of peace, and she's sitting in her apartment alone smoking that pot. And I didn't say to Jane, do a hymn. I just said, you know that character well enough. We've rehearsed this thing long enough. Let's see what you feel like. And she sat there, and she started to hum in this pot-like trance that this character's in. Da 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 da. And there was this hymn that most of us have all learned at Thanksgiving as children in school. And suddenly you could see this character in some small town somewhere, having been an ordinary little child or with some kind of upbringing we could all relate to. That just came out of Jane, just as Jane insisted on having health food in the refrigerator in that apartment. And it, again, created a fascinating tension of a girl who has this most self-destructive kind of behavior, being a prostitute, and then goes home and stocks her refrigerator full of health food and makes herself all sorts of health food mixes. That's the kind of work I ask from actors. We sometimes try to create together, and I also encourage them to do it for themselves.
Alan Pakula speaking with Fresh Air guest host Sedge Thompson in 1990. Pakula died yesterday in a freak car accident.